3300, and you're supposed to tune the inductor and the capacitor for maximum needle deflection. The needle only deflected on 40 meters, so I don't know what that was about, but I determined that this artificial ground, as you say, Roy, is pretty useless. Go ahead.
Yeah, it's a nice idea, but ultimately, functionally, I haven't bumped into too many people who bless them. You know, it's your mileage might vary. Some people, obviously, you could give people a brick, and you'll find at least one or two guys who think it really helps their transmission. So, you know, anyway, grounds, yeah, and again, you got an entire second edition of the ARRL of grounding and bonding. It's not a simple subject, unfortunately, and if you try to simplify it to a one-hour discussion, unfortunately, you don't really get anywhere. But that won't stop people from keeping on doing it because it generates interest, and that's part of the point of the argument. So, Wesley, I think you wanted to say something on the subject?
Yeah, both of you were actually making a good comment talking about the garden ground. First of all, the mirror image, it was excellent. It was absolutely excellent. And the second thing, you say that garden ground is related to counterpoise, and that is actually the same. So when talking about mirror image and talking about the counterpoise, it's actually the same, only different wording used. So I do thank you, both of you, for putting it this way.
You're welcome, Wesley. I mean, this is the nature of technology generally. You can use a lot of different analogies. You can use a lot of different words. The English language is rich with different words that serve almost the same purpose. They have their own little subtle differences. But, you know, I mean, it's always good to kind of use them to have an interesting discussion. But, you know, sometimes when you go down to 80 meters, there are guys arguing with all these concepts. And again, the old line is, if you're not having fun, you're doing it wrong. So I'm always glad to discuss these things. Again, you're free to completely disagree with me and walk away and say, the smart lady from MIT knows better than Roy, ground this. And I guess you could chop off the ground plugs on your outlets and violate the electrical code. And if they come to get you, you just point you towards the ARRL, and I'm sure they'll protect you. Anyway, I think we knocked that around enough. Rich, I assume we at least attempted to address all three of your comments tonight. I hope it's okay.
Yes, absolutely. Just one last thing on ground. I'm using an NFED half wave, and I don't know where the other half of the antenna is. Just a piece of wire. There's a coil in the middle of it to lengthen it, artificially lengthen it, and it's going into a 49-to-1 transformer, and then coax from the transformer into the radio. So I do not know where ground comes in an antenna like that, Roy.
Do you have a choke on that?
Yes. I have a choke, and I have multiple. I mean, I have like 30 beads on each wire that's involved in my setup. So all the coax going from the antenna tuner to the SWR meter and whatever, and also the power line coming from the power supply to the 7300, all of those have ferrite beads on them. I put like 6 ferrite beads on the power line coming from the power supply into the radio. And then the other ones have about 4 ferrite beads on each of them. And yes, I do have, in fact, on this radio, on this antenna, I have 2 RF chokes, Roy.
Okay, but it's beyond the antenna feed itself. The shield of your coaxial cable up until the RF choke is your counterpoise.
The only coaxial cable that comes into this antenna system is the one from the balun or the transformer to the radio, which is only about 4 feet. That's the only coax in the system.
Yeah, you don't need a long counterpoise for a half wavelength antenna. So that's your counterpoise. Your balun is not choking common mode current. It's simply transforming the impedance. If you had a 1-to-1 balun, that would choke RF. Or if you have an RF choke, that would choke RF. But 4 feet after the balun is sufficient for the laws of physics to work it as a counterpoise. I mean, people have been known to have shorter counterpoises for half wavelength NSAIDs.
Oh, Tommy.
You're a big proponent of ferrite beads, aren't you? You have them all over the place, too, right?
Yeah, they're relatively inexpensive, and they don't cause any problems. If you overdo it, it doesn't cause anything, except a slight decrease in your bank account.
Yeah, I bought a 100-piece set from AliExpress for $24, and I have them all over the place. I don't know if they're needed or not, because the only ferrite beads I had before I bought this set of them were like 5 ferrite beads on the coax coming from the 49-to-1 transformer. So the radio worked fine then too. So, but I put them all over the place because everybody says that they're important. So, yeah. Thanks for answering my discussing my 3 comments, and I'll sit back and listen now, Roy. Thanks. W2BZ.
Okay, very good, Rich. And thank you for participating. As always, I do appreciate it. And one little proviso to drop before we completely drop this subject is I prefer having a lot of trust in guys that I buy my ferrites from, because there are more than a few ferrite mixes, and some are very useful for the frequencies that we use, and some are not. And if it's stamped with the mix, that's great, but very rarely I found ferrite to be proper, to be stamped. Usually some people who are real smart can kind of tell by the luster of the surface of it what mix it might be. But, you know, if you buy from a dubious, you know, off the truck someplace, very possible that they'll give you some ferrite mix that's not designed for our frequencies at all, and they don't really work as well. So caveat emptor. I like to buy my ferrites. They're not that expensive if you buy them in the United States. So, you know, I take the hit rather than get them from AliExpress, because I don't particularly trust them. I buy things from them. They're usually low-cost things, and so if it doesn't come or get screwed up somehow, I don't try too much. But caveat emptor with Chinese stuff, unfortunately.
I'm just hoping they're type 31, which I think is the preferred type for our frequencies, but I really don't know what they are.
Yeah, that's a preferable mix. But they actually, because I have a few that are different mixes, and you can kind of look at the inside of them, and they have a different sheen on the surface. I don't think you can depend upon that, but there are some characteristics differences where you could look at a ferrite and say, this is not a 31. I don't know what it is, but it's not a 31. So I hope it works out. I have no real reason to doubt Alibaba. It's just I have no real reason to trust them either. Yes, Wesley?
No, it's Brian.
Yeah, it's not about the threat mix. It's about the permeability. So, the lower, the higher the permeability, the lower the frequency it handles. And as far as the power, it's just the size of the threat. That's all. Question for you, can we move further?
Yeah, we'll do it in a second. I just want to say, but the mix determines the permeability. That's the whole reason why there are different mixes. And, Brian, you were doubling with Wesley, so it was both of you. Wesley, Brian, you wanted to say something, and then maybe we can move on?
Well, this has to do with RFI.
Is it a separate question entirely?
I actually walked out of the room. Is it, does this issue deal with RFI?
K2RY.
Yeah, David recognized. It was just a generalization using ferrites. For the most part, it's not radio. It's not just RFI from other sources of radio emissions that your antenna is picking up. This is primarily using ferrites to use them as common mode blocks for RF coming back into your antenna. So I wouldn't quite call it as RFI, because RFI could be any RF energy in your locale that's being picked up by your antenna system, and common mode chokes from ferrites is not going to affect them, unfortunately.
I have a fairly decent problem with RFI in my home, where my washer machine will turn on, my dryer will turn on. The quality and amount of RF shielding or EMI shielding with these devices, I mean, it's truly amazing how poorly engineered these devices are.
Yeah, I agree with you. We've repeatedly discussed how manufacturers have decided to cut as many corners as possible. Appliances that used to survive 30 years are lucky if you get them for 8 years, and they're poorly designed, they're poorly manufactured, but no one seems to care that enough to kind of stop buying from these companies, so they continue to do that to us.
I mean, to me, it's really amazing, because I open up these, I open up a dryer, the circuit boards have no shielding around them at all, not zero. And you never know where the RFI could get into, so just putting it on an AC line, let's put it this way. I have four main RFI problems in my home. And one I totally eliminated with the use of ferrites. One I partially eliminated, and the other two did not have any remediation with the use of ferrites. It's just, it's so involved that when you get down to the circuit board level, that there, you have to build a Faraday cage, I think.
Yeah, we talked about that a couple of weeks ago. It's consumerism. We live in a weird disposable society where you buy yourself an air conditioner, you buy yourself a refrigerator, you buy yourself a washer and a dryer, and if you get it past about 6-7 years, you consider yourself lucky. You talk to some guy who bought these appliances before something like 2000. They've had it for 30 years, and they don't understand these things. So this is kind of a bifurcation of consumers, guys who held on to their old stuff and are still able to use it. I mean, my refrigerator, I bought my refrigerator in 2000. It's still working. It's fine. My sister, I think, is on her fourth or fifth in the last 20 years, and, you know, I doubt that they abuse it that much. It's just that she kind of fell off the track with the 2,000-plus cheaply made products, and that's going to be our future for the foreseeable time, as far as I can see it.
Thank you, Roy.
A comment.
Sure.
Yeah, I just wanted to totally agree with your comments there about the lack of shielding in these modern appliances. I can say there's very little shielding. I have a washing machine and a dryer that dates back from the 1980s. It's an old Maytag. The timer in that, of course, is just a disc with you know, plating on certain things that, as it rotates with a motor, it picks up certain electrical contacts that starts the pump and does this and does that. Nowadays, that's all done by a microprocessor, so again, it's subject to any kind of RF pickup on its logic lines or anything that could cause logic errors and cause things to turn on. One thing that greatly surprised me, though, just let me drop. One thing that greatly surprised me was that my generator, my Generac, I called the company and asked them if they did any electromagnetic compatibility testing. Now, you would think that a standby emergency generator that might be used to power, say, standby transmitting equipment or something like that might be close to a radio emitting source. You think they would do EMC testing on it. They said they don't do any testing for electromagnetic susceptibility or EMC compatibility. And I was greatly surprised at that. Oh, go ahead.
Again, I can understand. Yeah, Brian, we'll get to you, I promise. I think they just don't want to test for anything that they don't have to test. And since they're not an RF device per se, I guess they're alleviated from a lot of that from the FCC, and there'll probably be a lot more alleviation from FCC regulations as time goes on. But, I mean, again, they're cutting corners. If they still, for some legal reason, had to maintain a mechanical timer, I ultimately believe that the thickness of the metal would be thinner, the motor would be cheaper, all the components would be cheapened, and so you might not have a problem because of RF interference, but the mechanical structure would break far earlier than old-fashioned appliances gave you a lifespan for.
You know, this washer and dryer has been going good for 40 years. I bought it back in, I guess it was, just when we got in the house around 1977, 1978, and it's still going strong. I just had to change the belt in the dryer a few times and change the filter and change a couple of belts, but everything else works fine in it.
Yeah, that's, again, that's the nature. My refrigerator I bought in 2000, it's still going strong, so that's 25 years. You know, if you talk to someone who bought a refrigerator in the last 10 years, chances are they replaced it already. It's just the nature of products these days. You know, sometimes they'll build somewhat more professional, and then they'll mark it up 2-3 times. You know, they'll call it a prosumer model. And sometimes it will be legitimately more sturdy, but a lot of times it'll be the same garbage with a nicer coat of paint.
Are we talking about ferrites?
We've been kind of flip-sliding all over the place. We were talking about many things. We touched very lightly on the fact that ferrites might be useful, but might not be if you don't have a common mode problem, and you don't need a common mode choke, and you don't necessarily need ferrites. But if you put ferrites where they don't belong, it doesn't have any detrimental effect except costing you a couple of bucks, and it's a nice preventive measure so that you never know, someday something might happen with your transmission line or your antenna, and you'll get some kind of common mode problems. And if you happen to have ferrites on there already, it's a little preventive maintenance.
I experienced a lot with ferrites. The best results that I had was to get some, what do they call that? Spray, you know, spray to take off the condensation, the, what do they call that spray? It's WD-40 contact spray. And spray the PL-259 that goes into the back of the radio, and to put a few beads up by the antenna.
Okay, I've never needed to use contact spray on connections, but you could do that. There's nothing says that you can't. It's not going to change common mode radiation in your antenna system, but the ferrites, you know, you could use either clamps, you could use beads, you could use toroids. There's you know, more than one way that you could implement the RF chokes using a ferrite ceramic material.
WD-40 is not a conductor.
The super toroid.
Well, I'm not quite sure what a super toroid was. I think David was kind of clutching for the proper thing, and towards the end he said the contact cleaner, which is not WD-40, obviously. So I think he was just running through a few things until he landed on contact cleaner, which it would work. I wouldn't suggest you'd need to do it. You just clean the contact, but you theoretically you could do that.
WD-40 brand contact cleaner, and what do they call that? You know, when you condense, I can't think of it. Yeah, and I use the super toroid with the very flexible, very thin coaxial cable, and I must have made about 25 or 30 turns on it. Go ahead.
Okay, well, that's a hell of an impedance it should have, because every time you loop it around a toroid, that's the exponential power. So it's to the 30th power, you know. That's good. I'm not aware of WD-40, the brand name, actually sells a contact cleaner. Probably they do. I tend to use Deoxys. One can last you at least something like 20, 30 years, unless it rusts and corrodes and such.
Yeah, it's a deoxidizer. It's WD-40 deoxidizer. It's a much, how to say, there's more quantity of liquid in the WD-40 can than in the deoxid spray. Deoxid spray, they only give you a couple of ounces, and WD-40, they give you a full can. By the way, the super toroid with the 30 turns on it, it didn't do anything for me.
Yes, Wesley recognized this one, a comment. Again, it sort of depends what your problem is. If you have a common mode problem where you have a reflection down the outer shielding acting as a kind of secondary bad boy antenna, then it should impede the common mode current. If you have RF from some other non-common mode form, it has no effect. The only thing that ferrites do is impede common mode current, not the differential mode that most of your current is going through your transmission line. Wesley, you want to say something?
Yeah, I mean, I'm trying to listen, but when there is a nonsense, it's a nonsense. It's a complete nonsense. WD-40 is not conductive. And it is, you just go to internet and you Google on it. It is safe to clean up electrical components. It's oil. So putting the on your connector oil is a nonsense. There is a quote. The problem is that it's a dirt magnet. Okay, so whatever it says over there, and to AGM.
It's WD-40 brand fizzing spray. So it's not WD-40 as the oil, it's WD-40 as the deoxidizing spray.
Okay, I didn't find that. All I know is WD-40. It's non-conductive, it's an oil mix. So you have oil mixed with some sort of thinner. That's why you are able to penetrate into the areas they are rusted. Okay, and using it with peel connectors is nonsense. N2XGM.
AC2GS, I think the problem again is wording. WD-40 is both a lubricant and the name of the company that made the lubricant. And I say branched out, and they sell other cans under the brand name of WD-40, but it's not the WD-40 oil. I think they call it WD-40 Specialist Contact Cleaner Spray. It's a different product from the same manufacturer. It's not the lubricant. It's not the water displacement lubricant.
Okay, so I don't know that product. What I know from WD-40, which is the American manufacturer, is the spray that is used as a lubricant with the thinner in it. So you could unscrew the screws, fight with the rust whatsoever. It's a and it's safe to use on electrical components. And that's working from the manufacturer. Interesting.
It works good for me. It works better than the Super Toroid or any of the other toroids that I work with and experimented with. And I think the problem that I'm having is that, you know, if these contacts are left out, they'll get dust on them.
Yeah, guys, I'm on WD-40's webpage. They seem to have something like 40 different products with branded as WD-40. So, again, I think what's going on is although most of us kind of have and use deoxit, there are other companies that sell chemicals, and one of them is the company WD-40, and they happen to be well known for their water displacement oil, but they do sell other things. So they sell degreasers, they sell contact cleaners, they sell all kinds of things. So if anyone has a problem, just go to WD-40.com and take a look at their rather large product line. Yes, Ryan.
That's going to have a time for me.
Yeah, we're going to cut this real short, and unfortunately, we're not going to be able to get to Ed's question, but we'll get to it hopefully next week. So, Brian, what do you want to say?
Okay, I'm just going to go through this very quickly, and then I won't have any further questions on this topic. Regarding contact cleaners, Deoxit is a wonderful product, okay, from Cake Laboratories. The other product that I use consistently is called CRC QD Contact Cleaner. It has a blue label, And if you go under crc.com or if you look under CRC Contact Cleaner, it is an industrial-grade contact cleaner. It evaporates very quickly, totally safe on plastics, especially painted plastics. And you can get it at Lowe's. I believe you can get it even at Home Depot. It's in a blue can. And I swear by it. I swear by it. It works wonderfully. Now, with that being said, that was my first point. The second point is that how I remediated the other three points in my RFI problem. Well, besides having a dryer and a washing machine go on, I also have a china closet that goes on, and getting into the circuitry there I have done with no effect. But, you know, in the end, what I did was purchase from Home Depot a three-prong on-off switch where you plug in your appliance to the on-off switch, which sits firmly against your electrical outlet. And then when I want to use my radios, I just shut the appliances off, and that is that. So with that comment, I go back to you, Rory.
Okay, very good, Brian. I'm into home automation systems, so I would probably hook them up to home automation outlet switches and, you know, trigger, you know, have some kind of sensing that when I turn the radio on, it senses that the radio's on and it triggers the outlet switches to turn off. But I like little gadgets like that.
I would be interested in knowing what you're using because that would be pretty cool, you know, if you trust it, because I wonder if the RFI could turn those on too.
Well, that's an interesting point because modern home controls use RF. I forget exactly what frequency. It might be 900 megahertz. There's Zigbee and there's Z-Wave. You can kind of look up the specs for that. Personally, not that I have any kind of significant RFI problems, but my house is wired all over the place with Zigbee and Z-Wave, and I've never had any kind of RF-induced false triggers. So, again, your mileage might vary, but Z-Wave and Zigbee I've found them to be very good. I've used all kinds. I've used X10. I've used Insteon. There are different controllers. I have a home assistant. You can run it on a Raspberry Pi. You can even run it as a system in the background of a PC. I tinker with this all the time and to see what kind of new tricks I can have it for. Okay, I guess everyone's talked out. Maybe one of these days I'll have a little discussion time about home control devices. There are other controller technologies out there. There's interesting home controls that interface with the remote control so that you can have your remote control adjust lighting and atmosphere and such. So, you know, one of these days maybe we'll sit down and do that. Anyway, thanks for the topic, and I guess, unfortunately, Ed, we won't have time tonight for your question, but I think it's an important question, and hopefully we'll be able to address it next Sunday night. We'll make a little time for that. So, Wesley, what do you got for us?
Okay, thank you very much, Dr. Ray. A few topics. Our latest updates about ESO FTX-1F. This is the newest QRP radio on 2025. So it is Asia F6 meters, 2 meters, 70 centimeters, no GPS. There is a $35 prepay for reservation at DX Engineering. And I have to say the legal note, which is at best of my understanding. Crazy time has come to my beloved America, hasn't it? Okay, anyhow, I'm going to quote. The situation, the President Trump, the SEC hasn't approved it yet. and it is not known when they do it, they will do it, and will they do it before or after ham radio will be shut down due to whatever situation it is. But at the X1F shows in England already, and it is a 50 euro, which is about $80, pre-sale reservation. So the price is unknown yet, but it is expected that the price is going up due to the tax unpredictability roller coaster of today's, hoping not to lose its consciousness. Another quote is, the prepay reservation is not returnable and it doesn't add to the price. Depends who you're buying from. If the price is too high and demand is big, it is not business, bad business for the businesses, for the dealers, but you could use the prepay you lost much better. So if the price is too high for you, you actually not going to have this money return. So I have all scope for it. It's a beautiful radio and it's worth to concentrate on it, but I don't think we have the time to go to it. Dr. Ray, any comments?
No. Very nice, modern, very attractive design, and look forward to seeing it in the wild. Again, who knows how long it's going to take the FCC to inspect it. You know, things are a little wonky over at the FCC these days.
Okay, the next one. Weak signal SSB test flex 6600 versus ICOM 7760. And the majority of the responders said that ICOM 7760 is better, and there is a quote, I agree with your assessment, the ICOM is better. Now there are new, fewer models on the Flex, so I hope you'll be able to test one. Thanks for posting. Okay, so my question, because Dr. Roy has a Flex, what is your comment on it?
Not much. I don't have the faintest idea. It's not like there's a lot of 6600s and a lot of people have 6600s and 7760s out there. So, you know, I mean, this might be based on three guys. I don't have a 6600. I have a 6700. Chances are the front end and such is kind of very, very similar. You know, I like the 10,000 other features of my 6700, so I wouldn't trade mine in for an ICOM 7760 just because, you know, it has 0.3 dB better weak signal strength for a single sideband. So, it's all good. People who have ICOM 7760s, have fun with them. I have lots of fun with my 6700 from Flex.
Okay, thank you very much for that comment. Next one, electric car is for you to pay for it, but not to change batteries in it. So the question for the audience listening to it is, does anybody know what is friction welding? It as a no. Okay, friction welding, you're taking two pieces of material and you rotate one against each other, and then the place when two pieces stick one to each other is getting cut, and then the temperature is rising to the point when you have a welding. So this is called friction stir welding, FSW. For EV battery trays, electric vehicle battery trays on CNC machining center. So you take any lathe, or you take any mill, doesn't have to be CNC, and you can actually put the flat end piece on it, put the piece of metal on it, then you could actually move that over the battery tray that has a cover on it, and you're going to weld that cover because you're creating the temperature on it. So the car maker's quote, hold on. Okay, car maker's quote, because they represent car makers, right, business. Just like a fuel tank in your regular car, an electric vehicle car battery likely won't need replacing for the life of the vehicle, provided it doesn't cope damage. Nonsense. But anyhow, that's the end of the quote. All you are allowed to pay, all you are allowed to do is just to pay, for example, your Tesla, and buy a new one a few years later. That extends to many more other applications of permanently sealed batteries. I sent the video to Dr. Roy, so my comment is, imagine that you have a battery tray with thousands of small batteries inside where your touchy fingers are not allowed to be. The manufacturer wants to permanently weld the cover on the tray to make Mr. Joe Schmo stop looking at it, but how can you do it with those delicate batteries inside? So the friction welding comes handy on the regular CNC machine or regular milling machine offering not from China junk style, but clean American friction weld, where your eye has a hard time to find the difference between the two joint materials, and the welding apparatus, no paste, no electrodes, were ever used for it. So the history, a little bit about the history of welding, comes to the time when the human animal learned how to make a first fire, leading other human animals to have cell phones of today and computers. So the friction of the rapidly rotated by hand wooden stick or wooden piece in the hand of such animal instead of starting fire is used now in today's CNC, allowing computer control machines, right? Milling machines allowing today modern form of Homo sapiens to safely send money for another car, electric car, and not much more than that. So imagine if just one small AA size battery is faulted the very next day after your warranty expired in your Cybertruck, Tesla Cybertruck. And you need to spend $16,000 to $32,000 for the batteries, because some of them, there is an addition to the Cybertruck. If you have a double battery, you have a more mileage on it. Let me drop. Planned obsolescence, also called built-in obsolescence or premature obsolescence, that could cause such a fault. So welcome to modern Homo sapiens world of animals. So my question to you, and the question eventually to Dr. Roy, what would you do if your Cybertruck, let's say you have a Cybertruck, you spent the $120,000 on it, and your Cybertruck battery, one just single battery, malfunctioned one day after your warranty expires. What would you do, Dr. Roy?
Well, I mean, this is a real imaginative question, because I would never buy an ugly Cybertruck. There was a guy, it wasn't a Cybertruck, because I think this took place too early in the cycle of Cybertrucks. No one had a chance to kind of use up the batteries. One of the previous versions of a Tesla, the battery had kind of needed to be replaced, and he was fresh out of warranty. He basically had it hauled up to the top of a mountain and pushed it over. I guess that's a possibility. I think someone's playing around with the carrier. Yes, David.
Yes, sir. I just want to know if you checked your email. I sent a picture of a super toroid to your email.
Oh, okay. I'll take a look.
Thank you, sir.
I don't see it yet. It may take a little time. I'll look in my spam folder. You never know. No, I don't see it yet. Either it's very, very slow or you sent it someplace else.
RY.com.
Say again? I didn't, you cut off at the first part.
Kilo Golf at 2RadioYankee.net.
Not quite sure what that is, but it certainly isn't mine, so I don't know why you're sending it. Send it to rslaufer at rslaufer.com, or you can send it to anyone at ac2gs.com.
Well, it might be a delay. From what I can see, I sent to rslaufer, let's say to rslaufer. I know this is your email. I always send to this email. It says super toroid, and there's just one attachment.
Okay, it might be delayed. I don't have any address that ends in a .net.
I do, yeah. I started using .net because, you know, I'm not doing anything, you know, for sale, not for commercial. So I decided, you know, like, how to say, .net is, you know, about technology and electronics and microelectronics.
I guess so, but I find it confuses people because the overwhelming majority of domains end in .com, especially the ARRL is kind of annoying. Offices of the ARRL use an ARRL.org, I think, and members of the ARRL use a forwarding of ARRL.net. So, you know, the more domains, the more it could lead to confusion. So I find if the main name of the domain is available for .com, I register at .com. If I can't get it at .com, I register it at something else. But for my email addresses, I think they're pretty much all .com. So if you send something to a .net, probably with someone else.
No, I sent it to you, but, you know, I was talking to FCC and ARRL and, you know, about this idea of .com, and they said, you know, it's like there really isn't any difference, you know, whatever the suffix of the email is, in terms of ham radio, you know, that .com is suitable.
Yeah, I mean, there's nothing inherently wrong. It's just that I find if you ask people, you know, how does an email address end, you know, dot what, most of them will default to dot com because that was the first domain that was available. A lot of people have them. A lot of people use them. And, you know, nowadays, if you're willing to spend extra money, you could have, you know, dot lawyer, dot doctor, dot this, dot that. I think it particularly differentiates people. I think it leads to more confusion. So I've never kind of gotten into that. I mean, I think I set up a domain, LimarkTech.net. So that's kind of, I did that just so that it would encompass the name of the technical net. But no one really wanted to use it, so it's kind of sitting there not really doing anything.
QSL, Roy. Yeah, I use .net. I also use .com. You know, I have a whole bunch of different ones. 2RY was only available as .net. Otherwise, I would have taken .com.
Yeah, I agree with you. I understand the value of the other domains, and if I want a special name but I can't find it in a .com, and I can find it in a .net or a .org or something interesting, I'm more than willing to do that. But, you know, if .com is kind of my default domain if it's available.
Well, you know, for your call sign, you're the only person that has it. Chances 99.9 out of 100 that your .com will be available.
Well, chances are very, very good, but occasionally, you know, you find these strange places. There's a lot of people who kind of generate reams of domains with the hope of making it rich someday when, you know, someone somewhere wants the random name ac2gs.com. Fortunately, that wasn't the case for me, but I'm sure there are guys who come up with unique names only to find that some guy has basically planted his flag there.
Well, I have a friend who is an oncologist up in Massachusetts, and I remember when he was studying, and we would drive out to some restaurant, to some place, you know, he said that I should do this. And what I should do, this is what he said, you know, for every major university like NYU or Columbia or any major university, reserve the university name .com and then sell email boxes for them, you know?
Yeah, I mean, you can do that. Unfortunately, with people in the know, they wouldn't go for it because the only legitimate, say you wanted to buy on some kind of a student discount or something, and they have relatively lax rules, but they require that you have a university email address to to prove that you go to university. All the universities, their domains don't end in .com. They end in .edu.
K-G-2-R-Y. Yeah, I know, but back then people probably wouldn't know because it was sort of like the beginning of the Internet. It was like when Internet, you know, how to say 9600 baud, Apple 2CI, you know, people were communicating, how to say, you know, it was sort of like the beginning of it. And, you know, back in those days, I mean, I could even get my last name as a .com.
Because someone had it already.
So in 1995, I remember there was a doctor in Michigan who had the name, but then he gave it up. It went into the pool. I was able to get it.
Oh, okay, that's very good. It sort of depends. Unfortunately, if your name is John Smith, you're out of luck because someone got to it much earlier. As far as I'm aware, there's only two living Roy Laufers in the world, me and a stockbroker in Israel.
QSL and David Rappaport. There must be 100 of them in New York.
Yeah, I mean, especially David is a very, very common first name. I don't know how many Laufers versus Rappaport. A lot of people don't think that it's that common a name. I remember Dick was trying to figure out who I was at the beginning when I was just a guy sending him emails. But there are a lot. If you open up, if you ever find a copy of the White Pages for Brooklyn, and look up Laufer. There's hundreds of Laufers in Brooklyn. It's not a unique name. It's not as common as Smith or others. But there's very few Laufers that also have a front end tacked on Roy. It's not a particularly Jewish first name. You know, I think I got named after Roy Rogers or something.
Can you give me a whistle?
Yeah, the Rappaport, there's so many of them, and there's maybe 6 to 8 to 10 different ways to spell the name, and also there was a Broadway play about the Rappaports.
Yeah, I've noticed. It's not like Smith. But then in addition, you know, Smith has pretty much one spelling. I mean, there's the old English, S-M-Y-T-H-E or something. But, I mean, there's so many different ways I've seen people spell Rappaport. I think Wesley is trying to get back. So, Wesley, are you there?
Yes, I am here. I'm sorry about it. Can you hear me good now?
Yeah, the audio is a little bit dirty for some odd reason, but it's completely understandable.
Okay. So I finished, and probably the problem with my car shock cable, the antenna, so I'm sorry about it. So I was talking about cell phones on the moon, and I had a question for you who needs the cell phones on the moon, and I said that this question is not that silly as it looks like. Interaction. Hold on. Yeah, no, now.
Okay, AC2GS, by the way. Well, you know, I mean, there's some Artemis program, so theoretically we're going to be on the moon. I kind of unfortunately have my doubts because some of the people involved in the Artemis program and some of the people who's in charge of everything. So I wouldn't put any money down on doing much on the moon, but theoretically, if we ever get, shift into gear and people are going up on